Hello, everyone, and welcome to the In Defense of Plants podcast, the official podcast of indefenseofplants.com. What's up? This is your host, Matt. Welcome to the show. How is everyone doing this week? Are you enjoying the show? Well, you should consider supporting it. There are a lot of great ways to do that, and I could not be doing this podcast without support. One of the best ways is to buy some of our customizable merch. You can find links over at indefenseofplants.com. Just look for apparel. And the best part is all of our designs are customizable, so you can find a style that works best for you. Once again, just check it out over at indefenseofplants.com. But today we are keeping the theme of fires going, but we're looking at what's going on in modern times, especially in areas like Southern Appalachia. Joining us to talk about this is Dr. Don Hagen, who has spent a lot of his life looking at fire, trying to understand fire, and looking how fire can be used as a tool to help keep ecosystems healthy. As you're going to hear, there are so many unknowns that even trying to understand how to do this research is a challenge, but people like Dr. Hagen are really up for it. So let's just jump right into it. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Dr. Don Hagen. I hope you enjoy. All right, Dr. Don Hagen, welcome to the podcast. I'm really excited to pick your brain today, but first let's start off with an introduction. Tell everyone a little bit about who you are and what it is you do.
Hey, thanks, Matt. So I'm Don Hagen. I'm an associate professor of forest ecology here at Clemson University. That's in South Carolina. Most of my work is fire related, so I do a lot of work mostly focused on using fire as an ecological restoration tool. Primarily in the Appalachian Mountains, but I've also worked in the coastal plain, Florida, do a little bit of work out west as well. I also have a teaching appointment here at Clemson, where I teach courses like dendrology, which is a tree identification course, forest nice. Biology, forest ecology, forest communities, which is a summer field course. And then I co-teach our Montana prairie ecology summer field course as well.
Wow. Busy schedule by the sounds of it.
It keeps me pretty busy.
Yeah. So where did all of this interest in forestry, ecology, dendrology, that sort of stuff, where did it begin? I mean, were you always kind of a nature kid and then fell into it naturally, or did you kind of take one of those circuitous routes?
I was always kind of a nature kid. You know, I grew up in the Florida panhandle. Nice. And you know, thinking back to like the 80s and the 90s, you know, when I was a kid growing up, you know, the Florida Panhandle was, I mean, it's just an amazing place to grow up. I mean, I grew up right along the coast, but, you know, if you drew a line from Panama City, Florida, where I grew up, you know, to Alabama, just straight north, I mean, it was pretty much nothing but, you know, 90 miles of pine forests and swamps and, you know, most of it owned by timber companies. A lot of it was open to the public, or I don't know if it was open. the gates were unlocked.
You had access one way or another.
I had access one way or the other. And also back in those days, you know, being kind of a nature kid, an outdoorsy kid, you know, I hunted and fished a lot, and you could actually lease land from these timber companies. And so we used to lease like 6,000 acres. Which seems like, I mean, it's crazy to think about now, but it was like $500 a year. And they would give you the key.
Wow.
And so much of my life, you know, as a young child and on through my teenage years, you know, I had access to lots and lots of woods, you know, and
nice.
It probably stifled my social development a little bit, you know, but, you know, just explored the woods a lot, you know, hiking, fishing. Wasn't really interested in plants so much at the time, but that's really where it started. And then I remember all, you know, I do a lot of fire stuff now. It's a big part of what I do. And I remember this would have been the summer of 1998, which is an El Nino year. There was a major El Nino that happened that year. And, a friend and I had this brilliant idea. That was the summer we graduated high school.
No.
This brilliant idea. We were going to go camping in the Everglades.
Ooh.
In the summertime, which was
okay.
We didn't know any better.
You live, you learn.
And I remember like calling Everglades National Park and trying to get somebody to answer the phone, you know, so we could reserve a campsite. And I couldn't get anybody to answer. I finally got somebody to answer, and they were like, "You want to do what? You want to go camping down here in the summertime? Sure. Yeah, you have your pick. You're probably the only one on the campsite." But anyways, I don't know. It's a long drive.
Yeah.
From Panama City, Florida, to Everglades National Park. It took us 2 days.
Dang.
And I remember that year. It was really dry. It was a historic El Nino year, and the whole landscape was on fire. If you couldn't see a fire, you were in the smoke, you know. Wow. And through, you know, many sections of that trip, you know, we're driving through Apalachicola National Forest or Ocala National Forest or wherever. And, you know, there's embers blowing across the road and just flames everywhere. And it was like an apocalypse.
Spooky,
you know. Yeah. It was crazy. And I have this vivid memory. I don't know exactly where it was, but somewhere through one of those national forests, there was one of those signs that said, it was a Smokey Bear sign. It said, "Only you can prevent forest fires or wildfires." And that the sign itself was on fire, which I thought, which was crazy.
Man.
So a very vivid memory, you know, during a very formative time in my life, you know, got me excited about fire.
Yeah.
And people still talk about, you know, the firestorm of 98. You know, I don't know how much land burned, but it was a lot.
Yeah.
Fast forward a couple of years, I was in college at the local community college, and I ended up taking a year off, and I worked for the Florida Park Service for a year, and I worked in several different parks, mostly in the Florida Panhandle. But that's when I got to participate on my first prescribed fire.
Cool.
And it was this park right on the beach, and it was a first entry burn, meaning that they'd never done a prescribed fire there before. And my boss sent me there. I showed up, and I didn't have any training or anything, and I didn't really get to do much.
Yeah.
You know, but I remember I showed up to the pre-fire meeting, and they just told me, "Okay, well, you just go up there and you go babysit those stumps." I think I know what that means. I babysat those stumps, made sure and sprayed them with water every once in a while. But I got to listen in on the radio.
Cool.
and got to see some of what all the other, you know, actual fire professionals were doing. And that's when that was really my first exposure to prescribed fire. And I got to see these very talented and well-trained professionals, you know, using fire for ecological restoration.
Yeah.
And so that was really cool. And, you know, later on, I ended up going to, I lived in Ecuador for a while. I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Ecuador.
Right on.
Didn't do any fire stuff there, but came back and went to grad school and worked mostly in longleaf pine systems, which of course are fire dependent ecosystems. And then 12 years ago, came to Clemson, been here ever since.
Oh, wow. Dang, it's kind of neat to hear those stories that, you know, circuitous or not, there's moments that you can really kind of hook something into and go, yeah, that made a big difference in the trajectory. But now you get to do it professionally and with curiosity in mind and hypotheses to test. And so, you know, how do you go from, because, you know, the application of fire on the landscape is one thing, being on a burn crew, an amazing experience, really cool, like you said, to watch professionals do it. It's another thing to kind of figure out what we don't know, which is probably a ton, and then try to test that. Like, how do you make that leap into prescribing fire, doing it, and then, okay, I also want to study its impacts and the things that can influence it?
Yeah, I mean, that's very much the space that I operate in, you know, and coming from Florida and being in that longleaf pine world, I mean, I love longleaf pine ecosystems.
Yeah.
But honestly, it kind of that sort of discouraged me a little bit from working in fire, because it seemed like everyone was doing it. You know, there's some great scientists, you know, who've made their careers, you know, just, you know, on longleaf pine fire ecology. And, you know, I kind of wondered, is there really a place for me here?
Right.
You know, is there still a niche that I can carve out as a scientist? And And then I, you know, come up to Clemson, and Clemson is really, you know, at the foot of the Blue Ridge Mountains. You know, we don't have longleaf pine up here, but got plugged in with some Forest Service folks, some scientists that were here in our building, including Dr. Tom Waldrop, who was a great friend and mentor. And I didn't really associate with the Appalachians with fire.
Right.
You know, it was so different from the fire dependent landscapes that I had grown up around. And Tom really opened my eyes. Tom Waldrop really opened my eyes to that. And it was really interesting coming up here how, I don't want to say fire science is in its infancy.
Sure.
But compared to the coastal plain and compared to longleaf pine systems, there's so many unanswered questions still. And yeah. And that's, as a scientist, that's the kind of stuff that gets you excited. Even just like fundamental questions about the, you know, will it burn? What season should we burn? How often should we burn? What happens when we burn for the first time in a
right.
long time? Those are the kind of questions that we, you know, we really started out answering, you know, trying to answer here. And, you know, it's advanced substantially in the last 10 or so years. And there's quite a few people doing, there's quite a lot of good science coming out of the Appalachians now, fire related. But there's still so much that remains to be, you know, that remains unanswered. And so that's sort of where the inspiration comes from. It's like, well, I don't know.
Yeah.
There's not a huge body of scientific literature that you can lean on. And we're very fortunate here in the Southern Appalachians that I would argue that we've got some of the best fire managers anywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, fire management in the Southern Appalachians is complicated. I mean, it rains a lot. We've got a very complex landscape, and you know, the weather can be unpredictable. And these fire managers that can burn in that kind of environment, I mean, it takes some real talent and some experience. And so I've been fortunate to build relationships with those folks through something called the Consortium of Appalachian Fire Managers and Scientists. And I'm a part of that group, does a really good job of sort of keeping their finger on the pulse of what managers are seeing, and also just the land management questions that these folks have, and then helping, you know, direct us towards, you know, funding opportunities.
Sure. Yeah. And I mean, anyone that has visited Southern Appalachia, especially, or, you know, parts of the Piedmont, you really do think of like cloud cover, fog, rain, mist, you know, these really dense, moist forests that, to me, are the antithesis of trying to start a fire. Like, but, you know, whether it was lightning strikes or indigenous communities, like, fire has been a part of these ecosystems, but that complexity you speak of is where it gets really fascinating in the region that you do a lot of your work, because I'm guessing there are areas that are more prone to burning and then areas that fire would probably peter out pretty quickly. And even trying to figure out those dynamics has got to be quite a challenge sometimes.
Oh, it definitely is. And that's where you really lean on the expertise of these talented fire managers. Because within a burn unit, and, you know, we burn some fairly large burn units here, you know, 1,000 acres or more is not that uncommon. But you might have a mountain, you know, in the middle of that. And you've got every possible combination of slope and landscape position, aspect. And, you know, when you light that fire up, you just let fire do what it does. It's going to burn really hot in some places, and then other places it might not burn at all. But that's what fire does.
Yeah.
You know, fire is a natural process, is influenced by the fuels that it burns, you know, and the moisture content of it, which is influenced by all those landscape features.
Sure. Yeah. And, you know, I'm used to it. I was introduced to fire in the Midwest. So you get a prairie fire going or a restoration fire going, it's inevitably going to hit some industrial agriculture and peter out if they've done it in the right season and people are watching
right.
it. I've also, you know, I just spent a ton of time the last week in the Southeast running through a ton of longleaf pine. You see the evidence everywhere. But when you add the topographic complexity, I mean, that's where I think a lot of the weird questions start to come into play in terms of, like you said, the amount of unknowns that are truly there. And so how do you start trying to unpack? Because, again, so much has changed across North America, let alone in Appalachia, Piedmont region over the last few centuries. How do you start to piece together history and then what you can kind of put together today with these prescribed burns?
Yeah, you know, it is very much a piecemeal approach. You know, there's folks out there that strongly believe that fire did not occur with much regularity here. Not so much in the scientific community,
sure.
but outside of it. But, you know, if you go, you can be right there on the Georgia, North Carolina, South Carolina border, which is, you know, one of the rainiest places in the continental U.S. You know, you get 80 or 90 inches of rain a year, sometimes more. Mm-hmm. I think in 2018, we got 130 inches of rain or something crazy. Oh, yeah. Something crazy.
I remember that year.
Yeah, it was super wet. And so, yeah, it doesn't make logical sense, at least at first glance, that this would be a flammable landscape. But we've got this nice warm climate. We've got long growing seasons and we get a lot of rain. I mean, what that is a, you know, that's the formula for producing plant growth, and plant growth is fuels, right? Mm-hmm. And you do have these periods where it just doesn't rain. Like we're not going to hardly get any rain this week. And those fuels are going to dry out and they're going to combust if there's an ignition source.
Right.
Right. So, you know, just a basic understanding of fuel dynamics, you can start with that. But also, if you look at that same area on a map, you know, we have Table Mountain pine. And Table Mountain pine is endemic to the central and southern Appalachians. You find it on these sort of, you know, lower and middle elevation slopes, I guess from about North Georgia to maybe Pennsylvania, but only in the Appalachians. And it's got serotonous cones, right? So it's only found there in you know, many of these, you know, really wet places. And its cones will only open when they're heated. So I think that's some pretty strong evidence that fire has been here for a long time, because that adaptation didn't just evolve,
right. Yeah.
You know.
Oops.
You know, there's been some work as well with, you know, looking at pollen and charcoal as well, to at least give a very coarse idea of how long fire has been on the landscape. And it's you know, many thousands of years, you know, collecting, you know, sediment cores from, you know, Appalachian bogs and so forth.
Wow.
You can look at, you know, some of the early accounts of, you know, botanists and explorers that came through here. Mm-hmm. You know, starting with, you know, like in the 1600s, they described vast parts of it as savanna.
Yeah.
You know, here in the Piedmont, right here at the edge of the Blue Ridge. And then if you read some of William Bartram's accounts from the 1770s, he describes, you know, coming down the western slopes of some of these mountains around the Blue Ridge escarpment. And it was, you know, widely spaced trees, a grassy understory, and not very much in the way of shrubs.
Yeah.
So, you know, all of this sort of points to the fact that, you know, that fire has been here for a long time. We can also just look at what happens when we don't burn. You know, obviously yeah. there was a long period of fire suppression, you know, starting, you know, in the early 20th century for the most part. And our forests have changed dramatically in response to that fire. I said fire suppression, really it's fire exclusion.
Yeah, yeah.
And these diverse, you know, very heterogeneous forests that historically existed across this landscape just get homogenized. These more generalist opportunistic species like maples and so forth, you know, fire historically probably would have controlled them in all but the wettest landscape positions, and now they're just sort of everywhere.
Yeah.
And that's a phenomenon that's very well documented all over the East, really.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we call mesification.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, going back to what you said in the beginning, Smoky Bear, right? And
right.
I grew up thinking any fire is bad. If it's getting out of control, you got to get it in control or stop it entirely. And that's exactly what you just hinted at. And when you think of, like, when the indigenous communities were removed from the land, people stopped burning nearly, you know, if they were still doing it at all. And then you've got generations, at least a couple generations, of never experiencing that. And so going back to what you right. said, sort of this idea that, well, like, I've never seen it burn. It, my granddaddy never said it burned. Like, there is a long history of, like, oops, we forgot. And now it's
right.
taking that effort of going through the soil cores, figuring out what would have happened, what evidence was there. And then, you know, looking again at species composition, and saying, like, why would a serotonous species exist here if there wasn't at least some level fire? But I think it also plays into the heterogeneity of a place like Appalachia, is just how weird the habitat mix can be sometimes. And yeah, maybe this spot didn't burn, but the spot over there on the ridge definitely did.
Right.
Ooh, you got your work cut out for you.
Yeah, there's the more we learn, the more we realize that there's a lot that we just don't know. But you know, one other piece of evidence that I forgot to mention is fire scarred trees. Particularly, yellow pines, species like table mountain pine and pitch pine, shortleaf to an extent. Mm-hmm. When they're scarred, when they're damaged by fire but not killed, it leaves basically a timestamp, when that fire was. And then it'll go around it, it'll get burned again. And there's been a good many fire history studies really all over the country. There have not been a whole lot of them. They looked at fire scars, but there have not been a whole lot of them here in the Southern Appalachians. We've tried. The problem is it is so wet that these old stumps and stuff tend to decompose.
Yeah.
But we have found trees on the Blue Ridge Escarpment with as many as 16 fire scars.
Wow.
And those scars probably, dated from the, late 1700s up until, early 1900s. So sure. Happening at a, pretty, regular intervals.
Yeah. And so thinking of the work you do, because restoration is so much a part of that, getting fire back on the landscape. And one thing that's always kind of struck me is when you get into areas that are heavily managed with fire in a good way, you start to notice patterns based on liability, based on weather conditions, where fires are being prescribed at the same time every couple of years. And a big right. part of going through your publication record is looking at the seasonality of it. And so, from a context, why would like a fire in spring have a different impact than a fire in fall or something like that? Like, is it important to consider that in every ecosystem you study?
I think it is important to consider, these fires that occurred historically were not confined necessarily to just the dormant season.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the burning that we do here in the Southern Appalachians falls in this sort of maybe January to early April window, which is mostly mm-hmm. dormant season. But historically your lightning ignitions would happen at other times of year, and your humid ignitions could happen, any time of year.
Sure.
And, if you've got humans, you've got ignitions. That's just part of being human. I mean, that's what people do.
Yeah.
So oftentimes managers have expressed some frustrations that, these dormant season burns are doing a fine job at reducing fuels, which is one of the objectives of burning. But they seem to be coming up short, or maybe coming up short isn't the term, but progress towards the restoration goals is happening maybe slower than they would like. And so what would happen if we burned in different seasons? And it's not, and we might just be talking about burning in May instead of burning in March.
Yeah.
There's a school of thought that suggests that, when you're burning, particularly in the early growing season, the plants that you're trying to kill, because you're trying to kill stuff with fire.
Yeah.
They're going to be more susceptible. They're going to be more sensitive to that fire during that period right after they broke dormancy.
Huh.
They've got tender new tissues now that are going to get that they just spent a whole lot of stored energy to make, and you damage or burn up those tissues, and potentially what you could be doing is creating like a carbohydrate deficit, right? You burn in the dormant season. Well, most of their carbohydrates are stored below ground. They're just going to sprout back vigorously. But if you wait until after they sprout back in the new growing season, they might just be more sensitive, right?
Sure.
It's going to be harder for them to recover. Not that they're just going to die after one fire.
Right.
Right. But you're going to force them to, they're going to burn up a lot of those stored carbohydrates without really getting a whole lot of benefit of it.
Huh.
And of course, they will still come out, right? They still will make new leaves, but they're going to miss out on a very important period of sort of early season photosynthesis.
Yeah.
That's when plants grow the most, is in the beginning of the growing season. The first part of the growing season in most cases, and you rob them of that opportunity if you burn them and force them to resprout during that time. So that's one thought, thinking about plant physiology.
Yeah.
Another potential advantage to burning in the growing season is that, especially in a complex landscape where you've got topography, is that your days are longer, right? The sun gets up to a higher angle, and so your fuels are going to dry out more over the course of a burn day than they would in January or February.
Yeah.
And so you're going to see particularly, and we've seen this in some of our studies, that sort of later in the day, if you're burning a large burn unit, that's pretty much a whole day thing. And later in the day, when the sun is higher and the fuel and it's warmer and the fuels have had more time to dry out, we tend to see fire behavior that we would not have seen, in the dormant season. And so we see more sort of heterogeneity in fire behavior, which ultimately I think translates to heterogeneity in the vegetation response afterwards.
Hmm.
So that's another angle. And of course, also, you know, plants benefit from that. You know, it diversifies habitat for all sorts of species, including, ground nesting birds and so forth. I think another, just from an operational standpoint, another benefit to burning to expanding our burn programs out of the traditional dormant season burn window is that I work with some very, very ambitious fire managers who have, they want to burn a lot this year.
Yeah.
And if you look at the Southern Appalachians in general, or really anywhere, we're behind.
Yeah.
And we need to be, if we want to achieve our ecological restoration objectives at the large, landscape scale, we need to take advantage of every possible burn day throughout the year, right? We don't need to just arbitrarily say that, the burn season stops in early April.
Right.
And if there's a burn day after that, we need to capitalize on it.
Wow. Yeah. It's one of those things that, like, I understand some of the reasoning against having a varied burn schedule, but at the same time, when you start thinking of those restoration goals, biodiversity, heterogeneity in the forest composition, it is, I can imagine it gets kind of frustrating. But from a scientific perspective, the other part that starts to get my palms sweaty for people like you is just the complexity of the data and the comparability between different sites in such a heterogeneity rich area.
Right.
And so how, as a scientist, do you take, sort of the restoration hat off and then put I need data that tells a story. I need data that's able to be analyzed in a spot where, a ridge might look similar, but the composition could be different. There's so many different variables that can really kind of make that data all the more noisy on top of already being ecological data. How do you go about that with, balancing the need for restoration, but also trying to understand the outcomes in a scientific way?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that is something that we're still trying to untangle, but traditionally, we've thought of our burn units as sort of our experimental unit.
Yeah.
Right. So you might have plots within that experimental unit, but that's your replicate. Is that, scientifically speaking, that burn unit is the replicate, right? And ideally you would have multiple replicates, multiple burn units. But in reality, especially in this part of the world, and especially when you're burning, we're talking landscape scale burns that are 1,000 acres or more, that one burn unit might have 10 or more different natural plant communities.
Yeah.
And you might have, 2,000 feet of elevation change, in that burn unit. It might be growing season in some places in that burn unit. It might be dormant season still at those higher elevation points.
True.
So what we are increasingly trying to do is take more of a community-based approach.
Okay.
And using GIS overlaying ecological zones or overlaying plant communities, so we know where our different plant communities historically would have been.
Mm-hmm.
And then stratify our sampling approach so we're not just so we can make sure that we're comparing apples to apples.
Sure. Yeah. And that's really nice to, in modern times, have technology like aerial imagery and satellite imagery and LIDAR to give you that tool, because, 1,000 acres is a lot. And that is an insane thing to kind of cover if it's flat and you're on foot, let alone in a mountainous system where, like, I don't know if you could actually access most spots of it without having some tools to assist in that sampling process.
Right. Whew. Yeah. You definitely got to be in the mountains. You definitely have to be careful about randomization.
Yeah.
We've made that mistake before. You take your burn unit and then you just get in GIS and you throw out, 20 random points or whatever. And that's going to be where you sample. And then you get out there and you're like, man, I don't want to go to that point. You might fall off the side of the mountain,
Yeah.
But, so yeah, there's, there's that practical aspect that we have to consider as well. But this is, you know, this is where having good grad students,
spry grad students.
Yeah, not only are they really good in the field, but all of this stuff that I mentioned, like using GIS and overlaying sure. different plant communities, they're so much better at that than I am. You know, like using the modern tools. So I wouldn't be able to do what I do if it wasn't for having some really great graduate students.
It's good. I mean, yeah, it is truly a collaborative process, even if it's mentorship or just no, you got to do this. But you know, the other part that starts to stick out is, you know, we're not working with just the species that evolved there in southern Appalachia. You're working against now, you know, another side of human influence is the invasive component. And in some areas, it's pretty gnarly. Yes. You know, okay, maybe some invasives get introduced that have a fire ecology background, but many probably don't. And so how does changing the players within a community affect, you know, your science, but also the interpretation and the way fire behaves just from a management perspective?
Yeah, that's definitely one of the things that keeps me up at night a little bit. You know, we've seen, particularly with wildfires, how non-native invasive plants can oftentimes take over a site pretty quickly after a wildfire. I mean, I've seen it in Florida. I've seen it all over. And I've seen it in the Southern Appalachians. You know, two of the big ones that we deal with here are Ailanthus, you know, Tree of Heaven, and Polonia, Princess Tree.
Yeah.
You know, they're present on the landscape, you know, but when you get a wildfire that creates change really quickly and dramatically, right? It blows up the canopy, it burns off the litter and pretty much all of the organic material. When you see really dramatic change like that happening quickly, you know, these non-native invasive plants, I mean, you're creating an opportunity. An opportunity has been created for them, and they're just so much better than our native species at capitalizing on those opportunities. And so there's a couple of places here in the Southern Appalachians where, you know, there's some long-term plots going back to the early 90s, and there was no Princess Tree and no Polonia in those plots in the early 1990s. There's been several wildfires since. I'm thinking of a place called Linville Gorge.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And there's places in Linville Gorge that are now covered up with both of those species. So there's some concerns there. I do think that both of those species are fairly fire sensitive. If we can put fire back on the ground and in the form of prescribed fire, we can whack them pretty good. But what really concerns me probably the most is invasive grasses.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's me coming from Florida. I worked with, you know, Kogan grass a lot in Florida previously. But there's a species that's really gotten on our radar in the last couple of years called Miscanthus. You probably know Miscanthus.
Oh, yeah.
And anecdotally, Miscanthus seems to be invading wildfire sites. And we've even seen it start to pop up in some of the places that we're using prescribed fire. We've got some long-term sites where we're using prescribed fire, sometimes in combination with some silvicultural treatments to accelerate our, you know, restoration progress. Opening up the canopy, creating more of an open woodland kind of situation. I mean, grasses love that kind of environment.
Yeah.
And with grasses, it can be really concerning because grasses can oftentimes create a fire feedback where, you know, grasses, pretty much almost all of their above ground biomass is highly flammable if it dries out. And if you take a species like Miscanthus that forms sort of these contiguous, you know, layers of fuel, it ignites and it burns really hot. So hot even that maybe some of our fire adapted native plants, you know, they can't survive it.
Wow.
And then it just sprouts right back.
Yeah.
And so it can create this sort of novel fire regime where fire happens maybe with greater frequency and greater intensity than it would have historically. And if you just fast forward a few more decades, you can envision a situation where it's just like a Miscanthus savanna. And nobody wants that.
No.
So most of that is anecdotal, with Miscanthus at least, but I mean, that it's called the grass fire cycle. I mean, we see that happening out west with cheatgrass. It certainly played a role with that major wildfire event last year in Hawaii, you know, with some species of non-native grasses. And so that's the kind of thing that concerns me, is all this great progress that we're making with, you know, prescribed fire as a restoration tool, that a non-native invasive plant could come in and complicate it.
Yeah.
But the good thing about prescribed fire is that prescribed fire, if done right, is usually accompanied by monitoring.
Right.
Right. We've got an ecological restoration objective. Well, we need to monitor it to assess whether or not we're making progress towards that objective. And so that's really important, because that's how you're going to find that first little sprig of miscanthus.
Sure.
You know, before it takes over.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, prescribed fire is a tool, right? It is not the only thing people are doing on the landscape, but definitely shouldn't be the only thing. And if you have monitoring, and then you have, you know, anecdotes that lead to hypotheses, that lead to data, that lead to, you know, scientifically sound, okay, this is happening, then you have other tools to start to choose from, whether that's, you know, herbicide or walking and just hand pulling, you know, whatever it may be. That's why it does take groups of people. It does take people collaborating, but you know, being on the landscape is a big part of that. But one thing that kind of came through in what we were just talking about is this distinction between the prescribed and the wildfire. And it sounds like it's more than just how did the fire start. It sounds like there's at least in many cases, there can be a severity difference between what a prescribed fire is and then an unchecked wildfire, so to speak. So let's clear the air there, because I think that's where a lot of the fear of fire comes from, is thinking it's all one big catastrophic apocalyptic event.
Yeah. So yeah, prescribed fire is done, you know, as the name suggests, you know, under a prescribed set of conditions, you know, wind speed, wind direction, relative humidity, fuel moisture, you know, and typically when we're doing a prescribed fire, we are trying to make incremental progress, right? You're not going to reverse 90 years of fire exclusion, you know, with one fire. We're trying to little by little reintroduce a more natural fire regime. And so oftentimes after a good prescribed fire, you go out there and you're like, it doesn't look like much happened, right? Because the change was incremental, and we're usually conducting these fires under conditions where, you know, the fuels, particularly your finer fuels, you know, your leaf litter and your what we call your 1 hour and your 10 hour fuels, like the smaller sticks, are dry enough to burn. But it's usually also under conditions where your duff, which is your organic material, right under the litter, and also your larger fuels, they're probably not going to burn.
Okay.
Right. They've got enough moisture. You might skim off a little bit of duff. You might char some of the bigger logs, but you're not really impacting those much. Contrast that with a wildfire. And we had a major wildfire season here in the Southern Appalachians in 2016. You know, these wildfires occur when you have these long periods, you know, without rain, which does happen.
Yeah.
You know, even here in a rainy spot like this, it does happen. And you have these really long periods without rain. I mean, like, in 2016, it was like 60 something days. If you get 2 months without rain, I mean, everything is dry, right? The larger logs and things are dry. All of that duff is dry. And so when you get that ignition source, it all burns, all of it.
Yeah.
And it might not look like a super intense fire. At a glance, it might look like a, you know, like a prescribed fire just creeping across. But everything is dry, and that fire is going to creep across the landscape into landscape positions that probably never would have burned in a prescribed fire. And it's going to smolder down into that duff and consume it all or most of it. And that duff is where the fine roots and also the mycorrhizae are for these overstory trees. And so it kind of sets into motion this death spiral for your overstory trees where, you know, over the course of the next few years, 3, 4, 5 years, you start seeing this overstory mortality. And so the changes with, you know, the impact of a wildfire immediately might not be super obvious in this neck of the woods, with some exceptions. Sometimes you get crown fires and stuff.
Sure.
But, you know, a few years down the road, it's going to look dramatically different. And it's going to create opportunities for non-native plants that would not have been created in a prescribed fire situation.
Yeah, it's eerie. I had some plots actually burn in 2016 with one of the bigger fires. And, you know, it's exactly like you said. I went back to visit them, and you'd think it would be like what I had experienced on the coastal plain, where you get fire scars way up on the trees. But no, it was the biggest, most disturbing factor was just how much root balls were exposed on things like rhododendron. And you're going, that was like 3 feet of litter that burned. I didn't even know it was that deep.
Yeah. Where were these plots?
Just Coweta, like right across the Ocoee Mountain Range.
So that would be the Rock Mountain fire.
Yeah. Yeah. I was looking down the barrel of like, I think I'm going to have to change my project if this keeps going.
Yeah. We did some work on that fire as well on the Georgia side. And we've got some long-term plots there. And it's been really interesting to see those effects sort of unfold over the course of what now coming on 8 years.
Yeah. Oof. That's weird to think about.
It's pretty crazy.
Yeah. And so, you know, in your field, I'm guessing being adaptive like that, when something happens, you just kind of go, well, let's make lemonade, right? Is that kind of just the way nature sometimes throws it at you and you just got to see where it goes?
Yeah, definitely. You know, with wildfires, you don't have the luxury usually of collecting pre-fire data.
Yeah.
And you oftentimes don't have the luxury of having replicated data, mm-hmm. you know, replicated sites. In 2016, we did. There were so many fires. But, you have to just take what you're given and recognize that these opportunities, if you look at what happened in Gatlinburg with the Chimney Tops 2 fire, it was a legitimate disaster, you know, burning down into Gatlinburg and 14 people died and all those structures. But it's also a unique opportunity that we have that might not come around for a while to study the impacts of these fires. Although I could argue that, you know, that's what the future is going to look like. Mm. You know, when we think of climate change, when we think of the volatility that we see in our weather patterns, and it seems increasingly these long periods where we go without rain, or where the wettest year on record is followed by, you know, one of the driest years on record. That kind of climate volatility seems to be sort of the norm.
Right.
And so those sorts of fire events, I think, are going to be more common in the future. And the more we can learn from them, the better off we'll be.
Yeah, for sure. And especially when you consider just the, you know, that's one of the most heavily vacationed areas in the country, let alone the East Coast, and you know, the human element of fire suppression, but also starting, it's alarming to think of how much it is and will change, like you said, over the coming decades. You know, it's hard to tell people that, the average rainfall might not change, but if it's all coming in 1 month instead of over 3 months, well, those next 2 months are going to look really weird, be uncomfortable. Yeah. So. And so with that in mind, I mean, you know, What are you looking forward to trying to answer? What kind of questions do you have moving into the immediate future with your work?
You know, as prescribed fire and fire science in the Southern Appalachians kind of moves out of its, you know, as it matures, mm-hmm. and we're starting to see more sites where we've been able to burn them, you know, more than once.
Yeah,
you know. We actually have some sites in Western North Carolina that, if all goes well, they'll get burned for the fifth time.
Oh, wow.
This week.
Nice.
And so the 5 times since 2001. So, you know, there's some places like that where you could argue that we're starting to restore a more natural fire regime. Mm-hmm. And so I'm really interested in that, you know, like, are we making progress towards our ecological restoration goals? And is it time to, based on all the data we have, do we need to change things up?
Mm.
Right. That's one of the things we run into with these long-term studies sometimes, is it's like, well, we need to keep doing it because we've always done it this way, you know?
Right.
But after, you know, sometimes after 20 years, it's time to say, okay, well, this is what we've learned. We need to take what we learned and let's try something different. Let's try burning in a different season now. One of the big questions that I have, and we talked about mesification, previously as one of the consequences of fire exclusion, is, you know, mesification is oftentimes presented as this sort of Eastern phenomenon. It happens anywhere in the East, you know, in these hardwood dominated systems. When fire is excluded, maples come in and, you know, oaks lose out. But the Southern Appalachians are unique because I think mesification is happening here, but you also have this additional piece of the puzzle, and that's all of the ericaceous shrubs.
Right?
You've seen that at Coweta, right?
Yeah.
You know, mountain laurel and rhododendron. These are not, you know, by sort of our current understanding of what mesification is in terms of like litter drying rates and flammability, they don't really qualify as mesophytic, right? By that, by those metrics. And so how do these ericaceae shrubs, which have also expanded across the landscape in the absence of fire, how do they sort of interact with this mesification phenomenon?
Fascinating.
My gut tells me that they actually slow it down, you know, because I think when you think of, we got a warm climate and it's wet, right? Mesification should happen faster here than anywhere else.
Yeah.
But it, if you look at some of this long-term data, it's actually happening very slowly, or even kind of, they almost appear to have stalled out, you know?
Interesting.
And so is there sort of this like tug of war between these ericaceous species and these mesophytic species, right? Because the ericaceous species suppress the regeneration of not only the oaks, but also of the mesophytic.
Quite literally everything, having crawled on hands and knees through many a roto hell.
and see, that's the thing. Everybody hates these rhododendron. Right. Everybody, especially if you've like set up plots in it before, it sucks.
It's rough. I love them as species, but boy,
managers, you know, or when you're out there working in them, it's no fun. But I also wonder if maybe they are sort of an unlikely ally in combating mesification. So that's something I'd like to, that we're starting to get into now, looking at the role of these ericaceous species in the mesification process.
Well, boy, you have plenty of opportunity down there, lots of land to look at it on.
No shortage of mountain laurel. For sure.
Yeah, it's just amazing, though, because like that is the first time I've heard someone spell it out that way. Not to say that that's, you know, the first time anyone's thought of it, but it's they're everywhere, especially in areas of Western North Carolina. And it just goes to show you like the amount of unknowns. And it's something I harp on all the time, far outweigh what we do know. And here's something that you can't throw a rock and not hit. And there's still so many questions about what's their impact on the landscape.
Right.
Wow. Very cool. So if people want to find out more about this work and keep a finger on the pulse of what's coming out of your lab into the future, where do you recommend they go looking?
Probably the best place. So I'm not really on social media, so I don't have a Twitter account or anything like that. probably ResearchGate.
Excellent.
So all of my, you know, all of my work is on ResearchGate. You can find my work on Google Scholar as well.
Cool. I will put up links to those. But Dr. Hagen, thank you so much for taking time to talk with us about that. And I think I speak for everyone, like, keep it up, because this is a fascinating world to study and a fascinating part of the world. And of course, you've got research going on in other ecosystems as well. And it's vital, because it's a really important tool in keeping the landscape healthy.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate that.
Of course. Well, in the meantime, hang in there and keep it up.
All right. Thanks.
Cheers.
See ya.
Fascinating stuff. Until I worked on there, you could never convince me that somewhere like the Great Smoky Mountains would have fire in them. They're just so wet all the time. But fire is such an important component of biodiversity, and I'm really thankful people like Dr. Hagen are down there trying to understand it and communicate how it can be used better as a tool to restore biodiversity. I thank Dr. Hagen for taking time out of his busy schedule to talk with us about this. And as always, go check out the show notes over at indefensibleplants.com, where you can find more about the research we talked about in this episode, as well as all previous episodes. While you're over there, look at all the great ways to support the show, because as I mentioned, this show can't happen without support. You can pick up some of our customizable merch, a copy of my book, and some stickers, or you can become a patron over at patreon.com/indefensibleplants, where for a little support each and every month, you get access to a lot of great kickbacks, including bonus episodes. But that is it for this week. I thank you all for listening. Make sure you hit that subscribe button and keep checking back in. But until next time, hang in there, stay healthy, and get outside if you can. This is your host, Matt, signing out. Adios, everyone.